Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I apologize. I might be a little bit slow off the bat tonight. I've got a cold, so. I guess you probably heard or put it together. Whiskey Tango Foxtrot stands for what the F. They're constantly screaming it over the radio when something happens. I mean, I heard it, you know, hundreds of times in 1 week during the Fallujah offensive. You know, when they would almost bomb, our position, thinking that we were insurgents, the Marines and myself. And within seconds, you know, they would call these strikes off. You know, we were so close to dying, and they would call over the radio, you know, Basher 5-4, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. I mean, so cold and emotionless. Except it, you know, captured a lot of what I actually saw while I was there. I mean, you know, troops on the front line, like, being shot at and, you know, pulling a donkey out of a palm grove and trying to do the Crocodile Dundee taming of the water buffalo and things like that. But also, you know, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, like, what on earth am I doing there? I've been going there for the last 5 years. I started in 2002. Because I'd been working with refugees around the world since, you know, like 97. And I realized, you know, when I got to Iraq the first time, I looked at the Kurdish enclave in the north at a state, all of whom at some point had been refugees in their life. And I wanted to see, you know, what they had set up for themselves. But in 2003, when America promised to invade, I decided I needed to go back and try to hold the Americans accountable for a possible betrayal, you know, as like what happened in 1991. But when I got there, I decided that I needed to learn what combat actually was. You can go through your entire career as a war journalist, photographer, and never see a bullet fired in anger. I mean, it sounds surprising, but it's true. I mean, you get into sticky situations, of course, all the time, except actual fighting doesn't happen very often in your career. And I felt that I needed to see what that was and how that felt and how that affected me as a human being, because I'd heard so many stories from people, you know, thousands of people, you know, be they soldiers, civilians, of these horror stories. You know, like how bad, and I was 24, so you got to give me some slack, right? But, you know, how bad could it be? So I'll read a few sections of the book and then, you know, chat for a little while and then hopefully take some questions. It starts off, you know, like I said, when I was like a crazy 24-year-old guy, and ends up as like a pretty messed up 28-year-old feeling like a 60-year-old. And the pictures that are on the screen are a selection of the work all through the book. There's only, I think, 24 there, except, and there's, you know, more than 200 in the book, but it'll give you an idea of, you know, the sort of stuff that I saw. Like Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, see? Polish soldiers sunbathing while the Americans fight. This is from the initial invasion period. It's called Stuff Happens. I was traveling with a fixer named Jeff and a filmmaker named Timothy Grucher. The following morning, Tim, Jeff, and I returned to the front. Neighboring Kirkuk fell to the Kurds, and officials from the former Ba'athist regime were publicly executed. Looters immediately overran the city. While most journalists in the north descended on Kirkuk, a small group of us decided to stay in the front row spots we had outside Mosul. Minefields stretched around us, and shells dropped erratically. There was little we could do but wait. We set up a small table, drank French wine, and ate Danish blue cheese until the city opened up. The following morning, we were the first journalists to enter Mosul. Driving into the city, we found just a few armed men, looking mean. In a war zone, deserted streets are the first sign of danger. We weren't sure at first if the men were Saddam's Fedayeen or Kurdish Peshmerga. Only when they didn't shoot at us did we establish that they were Pesh. The center of the city was a different story. Hundreds of people had gathered, cheering as they tore down banners of Saddam that adorned every government building. A man threw gasoline over a huge painting of Saddam, and another ran forward from the mob to set it alight. As I took pictures, I recognized the man igniting the painting. It was Jaff, my fixer. He was giddy with joy. When he backed away from the flames, I grabbed him and said that as my fixer, he was a neutral observer. He could not be involved. Jaff instantly sobered. Ashley, he said, first I'm an Iraqi, second I'm a journalist. The throng ran out of banners and murals to destroy and turn onto the central bank of Mosul. Its barred front doors had been cracked open by the Pesh, and the men who only hours earlier had been fighting side by side with Americans were now looting burlap sacks of money. They fired carelessly into droves of jubilant Iraqis attempting to get a piece of the pie. Then the deep bass of an explosion belched forth from the bank. Money started falling from the sky. The Pesh had blown the vault. The madness wasn't confined to the bank. People ransacked military armories and set up arms bazaars outside them. Jaff desperately wanted to buy a gun, for safety, he said, but I wouldn't let him, believing as I do that it's unethical for journalists to carry weapons for any reason. When I came across a group of men trying to load an 18-foot rocket onto their truck, I thought I was hallucinating. If anyone wonders why that picture isn't in this book, here's the answer. We were driving pedal to the metal in the other direction. Looters were pillaging the United Nations oil for food supply warehouses. From afar, the storage facilities looked as though they were being attacked by ants. People marched out in lines, carrying sacks of rice and boxes of oil. At Saddam's Mosul Palace, entire families looked for something to steal, light switches, door frames, whatever they could get. A man fell to his death as he tried to jimmy a banister from its fittings. Another man took a stab at it and managed to tear part of it off. Photojournalists dream of shooting wild scenes like these, but I was so sickened I had to stop working. Was this the freedom America had promised? Frenzied men with armfuls of cash wrestling free from crowds trying to rob their booty? America's Kurdish allies shooting anyone who got in the way of their meticulously planned looting spree? The entire infrastructure of Iraqi cities looted and torched? At the war's outset, I had supported it. Weapons of mass destruction seemed like a bullshit reason to invade, but I didn't care. Any reason the Americans could agree upon to topple that monster Saddam was good enough for me. I'd seen victims of his purges, the birth defects of children born to mothers who had been exposed to Saddam's chemical weapons in Halabja. His thugs had tortured and nearly killed close friends of mine. I justified the American invasion as a means to an end. I changed my mind, though, when I watched Mosul burn. I couldn't understand how the Americans let this occur. Stuff happens, Donald Rumsfeld said in response to the mayhem. In the following weeks, Arabs and Kurds, longtime enemies, sectioned off their neighborhoods with burning tires, bricks, and gangs of men with AK-47s. Turning down the wrong street meant death to many, though most locals knew what was out of bounds. One morning, Tim and Jaff went out to conduct some interviews. I stayed at the airport to find some soldiers who might spare me a cup of coffee. Tim and Jaff returned a few hours later, ghostly white and unable to speak. They had made a wrong turn, a simple mistake in Iraq's second largest city, and run into a gang of Arab men who had decided to kill them. They barely made it back. Mosul deteriorated into further chaos to become one of the most dangerous cities in Iraq. I don't normally read this section, but I think it's one of my favorite parts because it gives you a sense of what it's like to work at a mental institution like the New York Times. It's called The New Grunt. I'd been freelance all the way up until this point. In early 2004, Royal Jordanian Airlines began a direct service from Amman to Baghdad. A one-way ticket for the 45-minute flight cost $600. It was safer than driving, but threats abounded in the air as well. Insurgents routinely shot down military helicopters and had successfully rocketed a civilian plane taking off from Baghdad and International Airport, or BIAP. To elude attacks, Royal Jordanian's little twin-engine Fokker would descend into Baghdad in what felt like an impossibly steep and dangerous corkscrew, leveling out at the very last second above the runway. I fell asleep during takeoff one morning, only to be awoken 2 hours later by the captain welcoming the passengers back to Amman. My neighbor explained that we had made it all the way to Baghdad, but fighting on the ground prevented the aircraft from landing. Arrival in Bayap only meant that we'd jumped one hurdle. There were the sluggish and corrupt Iraqi customs, where bribes helped your small luxuries from planet Earth, only 45 minutes west, pass through unquestioned. Then there was the airport road. I hated this more than any other leg of the journey. It was a 10-mile stretch connecting Bayap to central Baghdad and was the most dangerous road in the world. The Americans named it IED Alley for all the improvised explosive devices insurgents planted there. The Iraqis just called it Death Street. Various options were available to make the trip: a military rhino truck, a rocket and bomb-proof bus that made the trip every midnight, an armored taxi service provided by mercenaries that cost $2,390, or in my case, the Times' armored car, which would ferry me to the bureau, shattered by an additional carload of gunmen intended to create a diversion in the event of an ambush. To really set my nerves at rest, Mark, then the Times' security advisor, would update me on the hellish state of the country, emphasizing each incident by pointing to the fresh examples of roadside bombs, suicide car bombings, and ambushes on the road. It always seemed to me he did it for effect. Well, Mark, here it is. It worked. My assignment in November 2003 was 2 months long, and my first major contract. In the past, I worked by driving around with a trunk full of beer, photographing whatever interested me. Filing every day, on deadline, was still a new concept, as was working directly under tough editors at a major newspaper. A small bit of comfort was that Jaff had landed a job at the Times, too. The New York Times' enterprise in Baghdad was like a military operation, and I was the new grunt. Ranked photographers snagged all the high-profile jobs, and it took the reporters a long time to warm to me. One miserable night in the newsroom, I sat alone drinking beer, trying to work out what the foreign desk was thinking. Did they like my pictures? Was I doing my job properly? I had no feedback from anyone. Two photographers strolled in and announced they were leaving to attend a party at the Hamra Hotel. I don't know why they bothered telling me, since no invitation was extended. Well, if war photographers had a club, I decided I didn't want to belong to it. I was so uncertain of my standing at the Times that if I was exhausted, rather than nap at the bureau, I'd take a driver and have him roam Baghdad's streets while I slept in the passenger seat. I'd tell the driver to wake me if he saw anything interesting. A photographer's mobility on the streets of Iraq was a good indication of the country's state. On this rotation, I could drive about freely in the mornings and evenings, talking to people, photographing what I wanted with little incident. Not 6 months later, most foreign press was confined to heavily guarded hotels and houses. But this didn't stop us from being attacked. The Palestine was hit by a double suicide bombing, the first one opening a gap in the blast walls around the complex, the second, a concrete truck laden with explosives attempting to pass through before getting caught in barbed wire and blowing up. Another suicide bomber destroyed an entire wing of the Hamra Hotel. When we could leave, a small militia was dispatched to protect us. Almost all drivers were armed, as were the translators. I knew of a few reporters from various news outlets who had carried weapons at some point, though this practice was stopped when security was beefed up. This is from, it's weird how like a short period of life can really define like the rest of your life, I guess. But this is from November, from 1 week of combat during the Fallujah offensive of 2004. I was with the Bravo 1-8, which is a Marine outfit that was really on the tip of the spear and who lost 20 men in the course of the offensive and, you know, had a lot more wounded. This section is called Crossing Cathay. Captain Omohundro led the Marines through the small streets and alleyways, ducking into cover wherever they could. The company finally massed in a small house at the end of a road. From the roof, the Marines could see the Islamic Cultural Center, a large building that was still under construction and thought to be a staging area for the insurgents. The Marines were separated from this first objective by a 6-lane road. The Marines started running across the road, their heavy packs shifting awkwardly. The inky morning light made it hard to see, and soon the Marines were under fire from three angles they could not cover. Marines answered the fire from roof positions established in cover houses, giving the gunfight a fourth layer of sound and deadliness. Dexter Filkins, the New York Times reporter I was traveling with, and I shouted to one another over the din as we sat on a swinging chair we shared in the lawn of a house the Marines had taken. Someone yelled, "Third platoon, go!" And 40 men gathered in a tiny covered doorway leading out of the yard and then set out across the street. When the second to last man began the dash, I turned to Dex. "I don't want to go. I really don't want to go." The last man gave me a look. I got up and started running with him. I'm completely unprepared for what I see when I run out that gate. I immediately think I should turn back, but I'm one lane into the street already. Everything unfolds in slow motion. I watch bullets kick up under the heels and soles of my boots as I run. I watch the bullets miss Marines in front of me by inches. I see men hit. I see men fall. Other men grab and drag casualties from the street, leaving trails of blood behind them. Three lanes down, three to go. The noise of shooting is deafening, so loud that I think it can't possibly grow any louder, so loud that I can't think about anything but making the sound stop. This racket and the terror of being on the open street is the first hell of Fallujah. In times like this, you think quickly and time slows. Two lanes. I see the low wall between the cultural center and the rest of the street, across a gutter and a dusty sidewalk. The Marines are running to a small opening in the wall, but that entrance is now blocked by men carrying the dead and wounded. Nothing I can think of is worse than stopping on that road. One lane. With a strange clarity, I think I'm running faster than I've ever run before, which is a miracle, since I'm wearing cowboy boots, jeans, have cameras dangling from my shoulders, and an 80-pound pack on my back. The wall. I realize I'm looking at nothing but the wall. Dust rises from the sidewalk as bullets hit the pavement. I lift my feet, instinctively knowing there's a gutter to jump. I hit the dust, take two steps, and dive over the wall. Beyond the wall, I see more dust and concrete kicking up around me. An insurgent is shooting at me from a direction I don't expect. I get up again and run as fast as I can to the wall of the cultural center. While running, I see Sergeant Ryan Shane being carried by half a dozen Marines. My finger falls on the shutter. I hit the wall of the building with force and fall to the ground, trying to hide behind a column. I lie there, looking up at the bullets ricocheting off the wall, trying to find me. A Marine is suddenly in my face shouting, "You didn't take a picture of the Sarge, did you? Did you?" Somehow I stutter that it's impossible, but even if I had, the Times wouldn't run it. I have no idea what he would do if I tell him the truth. It ran the next day. Navy SEALs and Force Recon lined the entrances and windows inside the cultural center, some of them bandaged up. As the Marines filed in, they fell against the walls away from windows and doorways. Many were now completely oblivious to the heavy fire coming into and going out of the building. Around me, Marines slumped against walls, unable to speak, occasionally crying, staring into nothing. They looked into a void, the thousand-mile stare. I didn't really notice it at first. I was in the same headspace as they were, in a daze, thinking that was the most dangerous thing I've ever done. This is the end of the chapter of Fallujah. It's called The Last Man. The company's final objective in the Battle of Fallujah was to get to the southernmost point of the city. Along the way, the Marines passed through houses, not through the doors now, but through the holes they had blown in the walls with rockets. They found huge piles of mines, surface-to-air missiles, ammunition. Other units found car bomb factories, insurgent propaganda offices containing computers used to edit beheading videos, torture rooms, and tiny dark prisons with shackles and chains and wheelchairs used to strap down kidnapped hostages. I photographed the men while they pushed south, encountering more heavy fighting. I was so tired, but I hadn't lost friends I'd had since childhood, nor was I carrying as much weight as these guys. I don't know how they kept it up. I just wanted it to stop. I would have done anything to have made it stop. One night I talked to the Marines in a pitch-black room about what they wanted to do when they left the service. Private security contractor, policeman, and so on. It was strange, sitting there in the anonymity of darkness, hearing their plans, their dreams. The question then occurred to me, what would I do when I got out? I didn't know the answer until long after the battle ended. The company secured 3 houses at the southern end of Fallujah on November 15. Their last objective had been met, but the battle continued. During a lull, one of the Marines told me he'd seen a dead insurgent in a minaret the company had cleared earlier that day after firing a tank shell into it. I told Dexter about it, and he agreed that we should go and see it. We went to the captain to ask him to alert his men that we were going, to tell them on the radio not to shoot. He didn't want to let us go at first. It was too dangerous. But then he changed his mind. No one but the Marines really understood how dirty the war was in Fallujah, that insurgents were using mosques as command posts and minarets as firing stations. My photo could change that. He radioed his men to tell them not to fire at us and insisted on sending us out with a squad for protection. The minaret was only 130 yards away, and I didn't want an escort. I wanted to adhere to my policy of non-interference, of not altering the natural flow of events. I explained this to the captain and also told him I didn't want the responsibility of being a burden to his men. But he told me that if we were going, a squad was going too. I wanted the photo so badly, and Dexter wanted the story, we gave in. We ran to the house where the escort squad was located. They seemed surprised that they were going out there to protect us, as though they didn't want to go. Under their captain's order, they kitted up. I ran behind them towards the minaret thinking, I shouldn't be doing this. I'm crossing the line. When we got to the mosque, it seemed empty. 2 Marines went in to clear the building. I knew what I needed, and I went directly to the base of the minaret. I was about to start climbing the stairs when I felt a hand on my back. It was Lance Corporal Christian Dominguez. We need to go first to make sure it's clear, he said. I argued with him that I should go first, but there was no point. Dominguez's friend, Lance Corporal William Miller, started up a sharply turning stairwell, with Dominguez close behind. I followed them up at least 3 flights of stairs, all dark and covered in rubble left by the tank shell fired at the insurgent sniper I wanted to photograph. Our boots crunched on the steps as we climbed. The sun began to light a path up the stairwell. Being able to see better gave me hope we'd be out of there soon. But then a shot rang out, and another, and another, and another, and another. Dominguez pushed me, knocking off my helmet, shouting something like, run, 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 as we fell back downwards into the dark. Somehow I managed to get my helmet back on as we tumbled down the stairs. I was covered with something warm and wet. My face, my jeans, my cameras, everything. I thought or hoped that it was water, set loose from a camelback pierced by one of the shots. When I stopped falling, I knew it was blood. And I started crying and running and mourning. Not a day goes by that I don't think of that minaret and Miller's crumpled, bloodied body. A battle finishes when the last shot is fired, when the last man falls. In the case of Fallujah, the battle will never finish. Not really, not for me. Many others fell after that day, but for me, Miller was the last. While combat has a beginning and an end, those who experience it dwell on what happens between those 2 points. We wonder what would have happened if we had done things differently, made different choices. We wonder whose lives could have, and should have, been spared. I still wonder. This is the beginning of part 5. It's called Yes, I Had Post-Traumatic Stress Syndrome. After Miller died, I had to leave Iraq. My picture editor at the paper, Beth Flynn, gave me permission, and so did Omohundro. The next morning, I hopped onto an Amtrak that had come down to the southern edge of Fallujah to drop off supplies to Bravo Company. We sped back to the middle of town where the Marines had established a firm base in the Governor's Center. Several hours later, I was back at Camp Fallujah, waiting with dozens of other correspondents, all of us begging the Marines for a spot going back to Baghdad. None of us could get out. All of the flights were full, and the public affairs officer was giving us estimates of up to 7 days. I was so desperate, I considered asking the Bureau to send someone to Fallujah to pick me up. But then the Marines' public affairs officer told me there was a spot on a convoy heading to the capital if I wanted it. Sitting in the open back of a Humvee was a ridiculous risk to take after having pushed my luck for a solid week under fire, but I took it all the same. I spent a few days totally hammered in the bureau before trying to go home. No matter how much beer I put away, I couldn't stop thinking about Miller. After he'd been medevaced, I'd run from the mosque under a downpour of insurgent machine gun fire, wishing one of the slugs would tear through my torso and kill me. Back in Baghdad, I no longer wanted to die, but I had no idea how I could continue to live knowing I was responsible for a man's death. The drive to the Baghdad International Airport required two cars loaded with weapons, five armed Iraqi guards, and the Bureau Security Advisor. It was virtually another military operation. This time, just 5 minutes into the trip, we were forced to turn back when a roadside bomb hit a Humvee on the bridge leading over the Tigris to the airport. I didn't even stop to take pictures. I just wanted to get the fuck out of the country. We tried a couple of hours later, only to turn back again, this time because a gunfight had broken out between a private security outfit and insurgents on the airport road. On the third try, we made it. But just when I was about to board, airport officials said there was no room on the flight. I bribed them with $50. $50 was nothing compared to what I would have given to have gotten on that flight. When I got back to New York at the end of November 2004, the Times offered to set me up with a shrink. I'd never seen a therapist before. I thought they were a useless bunch, that I could work out any problem they had myself. I learned pretty quickly that the Times were set on making me their guinea pig in a program they were developing to help correspondents returning from conflict zones readjust to life back home. In the paper's typical way, they found a therapist who had written the book about traumatized war correspondents. Problem was, he was in Toronto. For the next month, I spent an hour a week on the phone with this guy, pacing about my apartment, chain-smoking, downing shots of vodka, and trying to explain why I was blaming myself for Miller's death. The therapy wasn't working. I had nightmares every other night, though I often wouldn't remember them because I'd usually got to sleep by drinking until I passed out. Every morning, I'd wake up and read any article about Iraq I could find. I tried to read other news stories, but if they weren't about Iraq, I could rarely get past the first paragraphs. I was scared to get in a plane, afraid that it would drop me off in the center of Fallujah. I'd pick fights with my wife, Joanna, when she was trying to be supportive, and with strangers for just looking at me. I wasn't interested in discussing anything except Iraq, but if anyone who hadn't been there wanted to talk about it, I wouldn't give them the time of day. They didn't know jack about the place. No one did unless they'd been there. My shrink in Toronto recommended one of his colleagues in New York. This guy had also worked with journalists returning from war zones, as well as with refugees. He got my respect for that. I went to see him. Over the next few months, I learned that my benchmark for normality had become Iraq. I had come to see that any other way of life was a waste of time, to believe that being happy in New York when Iraqis were miserable was arrogant and wrong. In those 2 months, I started to snap out of it. I realized it was unfair, both to myself and to the Iraqis, to see life in Iraq as normal. Getting shot at isn't normal. Car bombs going off every day isn't normal. Celebrating by firing AK-47s into the sky isn't normal. Seeing people suffer and die every day isn't normal. I introduced my wife as my wife when she was actually my girlfriend, so I ruined the surprise. On July 14, I asked Joanna to marry me. She thought I was joking. I asked her again, and she said yes, even though she still thought I was joking. When I told my shrink the news a couple of days later, he sat back in his chair and told me that for the time being, I didn't need to see him. I mean, obviously, I'm still seeing a shrink, but you know, what it goes on to in the rest of the text is my return trip, which is I call getting back on the horse. Because, I mean, I hate to admit it, except you know, I think a lot of correspondents you know do say it in private that I mean this. Iraq is like a drug, and people tend to relate that back to the idea of, you know, crack cocaine and the adrenaline, the whole bit, but it's, you know, the adrenaline and that idea of, you know, surviving against all odds. I mean, it's, you know, it's a thrill. But that thrill, when you actually see men dying around you, you know, whether they're Iraqis or Americans or friends or both, I mean, the thrill wears off pretty quickly, and you realize the adrenaline is actually there for a reason, which is to get you the hell out of there as quickly as possible. I mean, I got back on the horse because this story is so compelling. The story is so important, and as the coverage goes on, I mean, you know, there's less and less of it in the newspapers, and that's for a variety of reasons. Largely because there's so few reporters there anymore. I mean, at any given time, you know, back in 2003 during the invasion, you had around 1,000 reporters embedded with the military, and then a handful of them around the country as unilaterals. I mean, today, at any given time, you've got around 5 reporters and photographers that are embedded. This is for the biggest story that's facing, in my opinion, our generation. 5 reporters that are embedded and with the military, and then maybe a dozen more, this is Western reporters, a dozen more that are, you know, working from hotels and houses in Baghdad. I mean, it's become so dangerous, and, you know, this is one thing that I hope this book really points out to people, that everybody who works there, regardless of your position, whether you're working as a civilian in the embassy, you know, whether you're working as an NGO trying to help Iraqis, whether you're a journalist, whether you're a soldier, whether you're an Iraqi, no matter what your relationship with that country is, you come back with some amount of trauma. I mean, everybody has their own minaret. You know, I mean, my touchstone, I guess, for how bad it can possibly get is that day, you know, in the minaret. But everybody's got that. And I think that, I mean, I was glad last week that this dialogue about post-traumatic stress disorder opened in the States, but I mean, it got shut down just as quickly when that report about, you know, homeless Iraqi vets living on the streets. But, you know, we're going to see a lot more of this as time passes. And if it's not addressed, then we're going to have a very, very serious problem on our hands. I mean, this isn't, you know, these guys don't want to come back necessarily and talk about what they saw over there. I mean, it's like I said in the book, like, if you weren't there, you don't know Jack. I mean, obviously, I realize that that's not true anymore, except that took 2.5 years of therapy. You know, I mean, that said, I think the press has done a relatively good job. I think the Times have led the coverage simply because they've invested more reporters and more money into the story while everybody else is pulling back on it. You know, producers say it's too dangerous, they say it's too expensive, where they're pulling back, the Times is beefing up the bureau. I mean, we've got a fabulous staff, but, you know, our greatest failure is, I'd be interested to hear what you've got to say about this, because I'm sure you will all have something to say about it. I think our greatest failure is that we haven't actually been able to show how bad it is. Like, we can't travel the streets throughout the country anymore. We used to be able to drive anywhere we wanted in the country relatively safely. I mean, now we can't leave Baghdad. Like, we can't, and even in Baghdad, we can't go to certain neighborhoods. We're so confined to what we actually see firsthand that we can't really tell the entire story. And, you know, while I think that it's still massively important that we're there, I mean, even if we're seeing a 16th of the story, then it's better than seeing none of the story. But, you know, if we could embed, if we could hang out, whatever you want to call it, with death squads, with insurgents, with civilians who have to drive to the market and get, you know, go through like 6 different Sunni and Shiite checkpoints, where if they present the wrong ID, they'll be dragged out of the car and shot in the head. I mean, I wonder how much worse this story would actually look and what our response would be to it today. The other thing that's, well, I mean, I guess more recently, the thing that's been kind of pissing me off is I keep getting questions like the political questions, which is incredibly frustrating to me. I mean, first of all, I'm just a photographer. Well, as you can see from the new grunt, I'm just the other photographer. But I'm not a Washington, you know, think tank. I'm not somebody who looks at foreign policy every day and reads everything they can possibly find about Washington. Like, I can tell people what I saw and how that felt. You know, whatever my opinions are on that, it's not some left-leaning thing or some right-leaning thing. It's like, I want this book, this text, these pictures to open a discussion in this country. I mean, and which is why it's so great that so many of you turned up tonight. I mean, I wanted to open a discussion that isn't political, that is humanitarian, that's compassionate, that talks about a dialogue that's about lives and how we can save them, you know, how Americans can be actually useful in stopping sectarian violence, as they have to a degree in Baghdad. I mean, how do we continue that? I don't want, every time I talk about this thing, every time I talk about this war, I mean, it's constantly politicized, and we're losing sight of the actual issue. It's all about the election. It's all about the campaign and what Giuliani or Clinton, whoever, says. Like, I don't care. There's 160,000 troops there. There's 20 million, or what's left of them, Iraqis in that country, and that's what we're not talking about. That's really that's the point of the book is really that. I mean, to give people an idea of what I saw, you know, what one man saw, because I certainly can't claim to be able to give you an overview of what this whole thing looked like, because I couldn't be everywhere at once, and I definitely don't understand what I'm seeing. I mean, I'm sure many of you find this as well, but the more you think about this war, the more confused you actually become. And I certainly have, and it's just, I mean, yeah, so, yeah. I mean, I'm still going back, and I'm still studying the story, not nearly as much as I used to, and my luck is got to be running out. I mean, this is a game of odds, and you know, the longer you spend at the table, the more likely you are to, you know, to get killed yourself. So my last trip was 6 months ago, at the beginning of the surge, and I'll probably go back for another couple of months at the end of the surge next year. And in the meantime, my project, I mean, I still feel a little bit weird reading that section where I'm in the dark room with the Marines, you know, when they say they want to be policemen, and I didn't know what I wanted to do until long after, because, to be quite honest, I don't really know what I want to do. I mean, Iraq was my rite of passage as, you know, not just a photographer, but as a boy turning into a man. I mean, it sounds so trite, but it's true. Like, when I went in there with a trunkload of beer and running around on the battlefield, like half-cut and dodging shells, and I mean, I took it like a joke. I took it like maybe any 24-year-old would, that I'm invincible, and there's no way that bullet's going to hit me. But, you know, I look back at that time now, and it's just, I mean, it was reckless and stupid. But it being my rite of passage, it's kind of hard to turn away from it, because, I don't know, I'm sure my shrink would have something to say about it, but it's, I mean, I don't want it to end. I don't want the story to end. I want the war to end tomorrow. I want the war to end right now. But I want to be able to continue covering Iraq. So what I'm doing while I'm not in the country, besides working out what I'll be going back for, is I'm trying to illustrate where this book fails, which is, you know, there's a lot of restrictions on covering wounded and dead soldiers. So there are a few pictures of wounded and dying soldiers in the book, but not very many, and that's an incredibly important aspect of this war that we are severely lacking. You know, even if we don't look at those pictures now, you know, we need to look at them in 20 years. These pictures need to exist, and they don't. So I'm trying to humanize the young men and women who actually aren't coming home. And I'm traveling around the country and meeting families and, you know, learning about these kids and working on a new book, which is just, I mean, very simply, photographs of their bedrooms with short descriptions of who they were and, you know, what their parents are going through since they've died. It's completely different from the stuff you're looking at here. I mean, it's black and white, it's panoramic, it's very meditative, except it's awfully heartbreaking when you look at this work. It's a gridiron helmet in the corner of a room with "Stay safe, babe," you know, a little note from his girlfriend before he went off to Iraq, or, you know, an 18-year-old bottle of Macallan's that he kept the empty bottle of because it was the only time he could afford it and he loved it that much. Or it could be the toy dinosaurs that he would play with because he was an 18-year-old boy. I mean, this is where the press's coverage is severely lacking. I know that we do the obituaries, and I know that they have little, you know, this is who died in Iraq today on the television, except as one mother in Arlington National Cemetery told me, you know, you see these names and you see these obits, and by the time Letterman comes on, you've forgotten. And I want to make sure that we understand. It's weird how you say we, like Americans. I'm Australian, but I'm trying to become American. That we as a nation actually begin to understand the power of that word sacrifice. It's bandied about like it means nothing. I mean, this is, every time you see one soldier killed in Iraq, you know, one soldier or Marine killed in that country or Afghanistan, you know, you don't look at that as one person. Look at that as an entire family. Multiply it by 100 friends and family who have got this hole in their heart that will never, ever be filled again, this void that can never be filled. And hopefully that's what the new work will do, because that's what this book, you know, while I talk about Marines in soldiers in the photographs who did die, you know, days after I made their photo, the idea of that being to humanize them, it's not enough. I want people to really understand what war is about, which is death. I mean, there's that old Plato, well, apparently Plato quote, that the only soldier who's seen the end of war is the dead one. So that's what I'm doing at the moment. And if anybody has any questions, then apparently you have to ask at the microphones.
I was wondering whether you had any direct contact with Iraqi civilians, and what were your experiences with that like?
Yeah, I mean, mostly, yes, I did a lot. I mean, you'll see in the book that it goes, it's interesting. I mean, in part one, it's almost all Iraqis. There's like a couple of Americans. And then in, you know, part four, at kind of the height of the book, it's all Americans, and the only Iraqis that you really see are dead ones. And that was a direct sign of how my access was changing rapidly, you know. So, I mean, the responses that I had from them were good at the beginning. I mean, they loved having us around, and they loved seeing us and talking to us. But then it got to a point where, like, what are we doing? Like, what? Like, how is this helping them? Like, life still sucks. Like, by talking to us about their family, it's not going to bring them back. And, you know, by opening their hearts and their doors and letting us into their homes and showing us, like, now it's gotten to the point where we're actually endangering them. You know, there's two reporters that continue to do fantastic work with civilians, which is Elisa Rubin and Sabrina Tavanisi. They're both, first of all, they're doing it because their hearts are with the civilians. They always have been throughout this conflict. But also because they can actually get around a lot easier than we can, because they get to wear abayas. The men aren't supposed to look at them, or, like, they're not supposed to have their gaze linger on them. So they can actually travel a lot more low-key than we can. I mean, the photographers who travel around with those reporters are generally, like, their cameras will be in, like, a shopping bag with Mickey Mouse on it or something. I mean, it's, like, it's so low-key. But, I mean, some of the time I feel like the Iraqis see us as spies, and I understand why that is. It drives me nuts, except, you know, for 25 years, they had state-controlled press, where everything was okayed by the government. So all of a sudden you have this idea of free press, and, you know, we're not, the New York Times or the Washington Post actually doesn't work for the government. It was really foreign to them. And now, today, you know, I was about to say that there's a free press sort of growing in Baghdad, but it can be debated as well. I mean, today, like, all of the newspapers are connected with a political party or a militia. You know, so of course, when you introduce yourself as a reporter, they're going to think or ask, who are you connected to? So yeah, I mean, I really like the Iraqis, but I've got so little contact with them anymore. I mean, I feel like I learned more about America in Iraq than I did in America. Sounds crazy, but it's true. I mean, like, I.
Hi. What made you go into this field? What was, like, the decisive moment where, I mean, with photography, you have all kinds of things you could do, like here in the States or anywhere else, but what made you go into this certain field, and will you ever stop doing it and go into another field?
I don't know about whether I'll stop doing it or not. I can't answer that. I mean, I think that, you know, your priorities change as you get older. You know, like, I got married and I started going to Iraq less. You know, I plan to have a kid. I'm sure that that's going to, like, completely, like, upend my entire world. I'll probably start photographing, like, flowers and puppies or something. But as far as why I got into it, there was an experience that really drew me towards this. When I was toying with various things, I mean, I've always been drawn towards social issues, like, always. Whether it's graffiti artists, whether it's junkies, whether it's skateboard isn't really, I mean, it was sport, but, you know, I was doing a lot of that sort of work, social issue work. And eventually that led me to photographing demonstrations and news on the streets until I met with a photographer who mentored me, and he was working for the State Library of Victoria in Melbourne. And He had a commission to photograph the Kosovo refugees who were, you know, unsafe in the safe havens in Victoria. And when I met them, I was actually talking about this before the show. When I met them, it was, I didn't believe their stories. I didn't believe that somebody who had been your neighbor for 20 years could come in, take your baby, cook it in the oven while they made the woman watch, and then try to kill her and her husband. I mean, how people could possibly do that to one another. And then the refugees come to Australia after going through things that I still can't even imagine how awful things like that must be. And then they try to eke out an existence for the rest of their kids. I mean, this drive, like this, it's impossible to extinguish this drive that human beings have to support and look after their kids. I mean, just to provide for their children and to go on in the face of all odds. And when I saw that, I mean, that was so inspiring, heartbreaking and inspiring at the same time. Heartbreaking that they'd been through it, but inspiring that they still wanted to try to set up a free homeland to bring up their kids and to have a future in. That, I mean, it continues to inspire me today. Got to remind myself of it sometimes, but it does.
Hi, Ashley. Thanks for the presentation.
Cool.
So I've heard all kinds of reasons for the invasion of of Iraq, and apparently it seems that we might be there for another 4 years or so, maybe more, and you're going back there, and it seems like it's going to be really dangerous in the future. But now, being there, have you come to any fundamental conclusion why we are occupying that and why it's taking us so long to get out of there and all the opposition towards that?
Well, it's taking us so long to get out of there because the place is a goddamn mess. I mean, it's completely, like, we could have planned to have made the worst possible choices early on that created this. And if we had planned it, I don't think we could have done it so well. That's why we're still there. As to why we went in, I don't know. I guess it's oil, right? Looks like it. I don't know. I mean, I think it's got to be oil. I mean, I don't think that a lot of people who are, you know, reporters at least, working in Iraq really believe that these WMDs existed. And they had been there. You know, he had chemical weapons, sure, and he had been working on nuclear weapons in the 80s, but, you know, that was depleted a long time ago. So that sort of backfired, didn't it?
In the introduction of this of your book, it talks about the downtime of war and that there are specific seconds and moments where it starts to, where traumatic events unfold and a lot of anxiety. Because the nature of your job in war photography involves documenting trauma, what is it? It's hard to formulate this question, but what is it like to be in that situation where you're documenting the trauma, where people, you're pressing, well, I'm sure there's a lot more involved in the photography of it, but you're capturing trauma in an image. And how does that work as you're photographing your subject in that moment, in that traumatic moment that they mm-hmm. experience, that you're capturing?
It's a really good question. I mean, it takes a really, really good photographer to get that. I'm not that person. I mean, I nailed it, like, I think once or twice in this book, and that's it. I mean, there's 230 pictures or something. And that's why there's so much text there. To really try to give you an experience of what that, you know, what it felt like and what it looked like. Now, actually being there when that stuff happens, I mean, you make a lot of decisions in a very short period of time. I've not taken pictures at particular scenes because I know it's actually going to add significantly to the trauma that these guys are already going through. Now, in other situations, it might actually help in the long run. While they'll be pissed off at the outset that you're taking the pictures, they'll go back and look at those pictures and revisit what actually took place. Because as a survival mechanism, your brain, I mean, my shrink likens it to childbirth. Like, the women apparently give birth and then, you know, it could be a 12-hour labor or something like that. And then it's, like, yeah, it wasn't that bad. But you watch it and it's like, Jesus, like, God. I mean, something so traumatic, so painful like that, the brain blocks it out of your mind. And so it can help in some way because, you know, they get to go through these images and relive what happened and try to, try to own it, I guess. The question is, you know, how close can you actually get? Because you can't be, you know, a vulture where you're just in people's faces when they're going through this stuff. But, you know, there is a way to approach it. And you can't, like, walk up and say, hey, man, I'm really sorry. Can I take your picture? I mean, there's... You kind of train yourself over the years through experiences, through, you know, an experience always means that you've, like, crossed the line a few times, right? And you learn, like, how to move and how close and what sort of movements people make when they don't want to. And it's not like that. I mean, it could be, you know, look, a certain look that they'll have. And you... It's really instinctual. So it's hard to describe, except you do... You certainly do have to make the decision when to and when not to, which is important, I think.
Hi, I'm also a fellow photographer. I just wanted to say that you have some pretty compelling images, and I'm glad that you came here and I got to see you.
Thanks.
But I really appreciate you taking that different view and kind of humanizing the soldiers and all that. And I wanted to know if when you first started to get into it, I might have missed it. I walked in a little bit late. But did you ever go into it thinking that you were going to take a political stance on it? Or did
Yeah,
you
yeah, I was totally pro-war at the beginning.
Okay.
Yeah, 100%.
Cool.
I mean, the thing is, it's important to point out. I mean, at the beginning, I was really hardcore pro-war. Like, wanted Saddam out, any way out possible. Like, I wouldn't have given a Saudi came in to get him out. The guy was a pig. I mean, I hated him personally. But you know, when I did start becoming anti-war, I'm not talking about, you know, like anti-war in Washington, anti-war when you go to a protest. I'm talking about anti-war in every single country. That we, like, this is something that nobody should ever, ever, ever have to go through. And whether it's 1,000 years of diplomacy to stop something like this happening again, it's worth it. I mean, it's worth it. It could be a lot of talking, except this, nobody should have to experience war. So it wasn't just a pro-Iraq war to anti-Iraq war. It was pro... what I understood, that there was such thing as just war, and now I realize that that's not the case.
I was wondering what you meant by when you said that you learned more about Americans being in Iraq. Like, do you feel like you saw a different side, or...?
Yeah, I mean, these guys don't come from New York and L.A. and you know, the East and West Coast. Like, they come from the middle of the country. And, you know, they're guys that will make agreements with you and you'll shake hands, and that's got more value than any contract you'll ever sign. I mean, they're miners and they're guys that join the military to get out of dead-end towns where they would have become crack dealers if they had stayed. And these towns of, you know, these stories that you would hear from these little towns that you can't even see on Google Map because they're like one house, you know. I mean, it was the stories of, like, real America, the stuff that I grew up on back in Australia. I mean, of course, you see the... You know, you see the pictures of New York and all that sort of stuff, except, you know, this classic America, and where the people are so real and where their word means it's their word. And what they were going through out there, you know, like, I don't want a dead-end job on a farm, and I don't, like, all of these... I don't know, I feel like when I'm living in New York, I'm living some, like, weird plastic existence, you know. It's just like everyone's, like, busy trying to climb on top of you to get to where they want to go. Whereas, you know, you go to Confluence, Pennsylvania, or Paleland, Texas, like, that doesn't happen.
Are there any more questions from the audience? No? One more? Okay.
All right. As a photographer, when you go into, like, a battle area or a conflict area, for somebody that might want to, or is going into that, what advice can you give them as far as dealing with the people, dealing with the two sides that's there, you know, how to get by, or, you know.
Keep as small as you possibly can. Take hard cover and stay there until you see a really good picture, and don't get out until you see that picture. I mean, you learn how to deal with it. I mean, it's just... like I eased myself into it, you know, because I had all these years with refugees and working in pretty violent situations before I actually got to war. So I had some inkling of, you know, what it was like. But it's pretty instinctual. It's instinctual again, you know. Like when you're getting shot at, you run pretty fast.
Hi, I'm wondering, when you first started going to the region, did you portray yourself as an Australian or an American?
Totally Australian, man, all the way through. It's amazing. You turn up on a military base, or even like, you know, a bazaar in Syria. I mean, the best is the military bases. You turn up, but like, you know, you have to file for embeds. All right, Ashley Gilbertson, New York Times, Australian on the form, and then, you know, they send it out to people, and then certain units will be like, ah, an Ashley from New York. We'll take her. You turn up, you get off the helicopter, and there's like all these guys like, where is she? And it's like, sorry, really sorry, you know, like. Last one.
Hearing you say that you're compelled to cover this story, could you share some of your favorite personal reactions that people have come up to you, or just on an individual level, or even a national one?
I don't get a lot of. I'm gonna do. I get some email and. I like when people look at this stuff and they realize that it's real. You know, particularly the younger generation. I mean, I think that a lot of, you know, people of, say, my parents' age, you know, they lived through the Vietnam War, and that was very real to them. Whereas there's some disconnect now between, you know, people our age, I guess, and the war. I mean, it's so foreign. It's so unreal, and it's so far away, and so it doesn't touch our lives. So few people actually know a soldier, know a family who's got somebody in Iraq. You know, it's when people like that come up and say, like, I had no idea, that I'm like, I fucking nailed it, like, good. Like, you should know that this stuff is happening, except it's so easy to ignore, and then they pick up something and they get hooked, you know, like. And I mean, it's awareness. Like all I do, my entire job description is awareness. So I mean, that's when people actually become aware. That's my absolute favorite thing, because that's what I set out to do.
Ashley, we really want to thank you so much for coming to Santa Barbara. It's been a great honor for us to have you here.
You guys were great. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.